Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management's Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney make no representations as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any information presented. This information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer David Lundgren, who will also serve as our moderator. We have Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton, and we have Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Tangus, and Martin Serrera. With that, I'll pass it on to Dave.
Great. Thank you, Ashley. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. As you might expect, a lot, if not all, of our call today is going to be a discussion around the coronavirus. It's been in the news really for the better part of, call it the last 6 weeks, but probably more prevalent the last couple of weeks as the virus has spread to other countries. Couple disclosures before we get into things. In we're going to talk about the coronavirus a lot, but we're not medical experts by any means. We're really spending a lot of time trying to read and listen to as much information as we can from those that are medical experts and apply it to how it might impact both the economy and markets. And like I said last month, we do understand that this is a human tragedy, that a lot of lives are being lost, a lot of people are suffering, but really our discussion is going to be around numbers. If it comes across as harsh or callous, it's not our intent. Our job is really to talk about how this virus impacts those two important items for our clients and for our jobs, and that's the economy and markets. This thing is evolving, and really 3 minutes ago, in case you missed it, the Fed cut rates by 50 basis points. So we're going to have a discussion around that later on in the call. So more to come on that, and things are changing by the minute. And before we really get into a lot of the market and economy information, let's go ahead and start with an update about the virus itself. And this morning, there were 91,320 confirmed cases worldwide. The virus, as many of you know, started in China. A lot of developments there. So I'm going to ask Richard Chauvin just to give us an update on cases, recoveries, fatalities, and maybe start, Richard, if you could, in China, and then maybe talk a little bit broader on the outbreak itself as it spread to other countries. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for the update on the numbers. I had just written that down five minutes ago. So when you look at that 91,000 number, I think it's important to remember a few things. First of all, 91% of those cases are in mainland China. Obviously, that's declining slightly as the cases increase in other countries, but still a very large percentage in mainland China. The recoveries, which you don't hear as much about, are at 48,166 as of latest count. The recovery rate, fortunately, is growing much quicker than the case rate. Matter of fact, some statistics on that. If you look at the increase in cases since February 13th, and I picked that date of February 13th because that's when China began to alter its method of confirming cases, and there was a pretty significant jump that day when they did that. So I'm going to start there. The cases have increased in the amount of about 51% from about roughly 60,000 on that date to today's 91,000. There's over 80,000 in mainland China. However, the recoveries since that date are from 6,300 up to 48,166. That's a 764% increase. So what that means is the recovery rate is closing the gap with the case rate, which is a very good sign, and we think that that will continue. Obviously, we can't predict that perfectly, but that's what's happening. It's pretty obvious. So that's good information. The other thing I'll point out is that we think that the growth that occurred in China, which was pretty rapid, is likely to be significantly less in the rest of the world, and that's just because the protocols are well known, the preparations are better, healthcare systems are better in developed countries around the world. So we think that that rapid increase probably will be diminished in the rest of the world. Also, I'll point out that most cases in China were actually mild. That's 81% of them were quite mild, 14% were severe, 5% were critical, and obviously the deaths occurred in that critical group of 5%. So those are things you might not have heard elsewhere.
Richard, the fact that 80% are mild or moderate is sort of a double-edged sword, right? Because you have a lot of people that, you know, may not feel that they're sick enough to even go to the doctor, and they're walking around spreading the infection. I've also heard that, you know, there are probably a lot of people that have gotten the virus, and because the symptoms were mild or really not even that prevalent or evident, you know, they're not even getting tested. Any thoughts around that?
I think that's definitely true, and I think that's one of the things that causes fear in the public. And, of course, there's an education process that's been pretty prevalent, particularly in the U.S. with the CDC, you know, telling people to self-quarantine and people coming back from overseas, asking them to stay in their home. There is definitely risk that it could spread further as a result of those asymptomatic individuals out there. So that has caused fear, and I don't want to discount that possibility.
Okay. Thanks for that. And, you know, I guess the real turning point for markets occurred, I guess we're getting close to 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, when the virus left China, so to speak, and we got more and more cases. You saw the numbers in South Korea, Italy, Iran jump pretty dramatically, and they continue to do so at this point. Talk a little bit about the spread to other countries and what the situation there is right now.
Sure will, Dave. So I counted yesterday there were 67 countries with some cases. Generally, they're very small numbers. By far, the largest number of cases are in these three countries, South Korea, Italy, and Iran. I totaled it yesterday. There were slightly over 7,000 cases in those locations out of a roughly 9,000-plus cases outside of China. So you can see that 91% figure in China still is true, but there's no question that cases are growing elsewhere. You know, obviously, China cases are leveling off from a very large base. Cases elsewhere are growing from a very small base. The U.S., as of today, has 105 cases and 5 deaths. That's up from 2 deaths yesterday. They're all in the state of Washington, where someone contracted it there. So that's the story in terms of growth in other nations at this point.
Yeah, and, you know, Martin Serrera, who's going to talk about the equity markets in a minute, I think brought up some really good points yesterday. When you hear the number 90,000, it sounds like a lot of cases. But when you think about the population of China, which is almost 1.4 billion people, that means there's 1,399,000,000 people that haven't gotten the virus. And then when you think about the worldwide population, which is estimated to be about 7.8 trillion. The number of people outside of China that have the virus, it's 2/1,000,000th of 1% of the population. So we're not trying to downplay it, but just really trying to provide some perspective when you hear those numbers, you know, what it means in terms of the total population. Richard, I think it's also important to point out that this isn't the first epidemic by any means, and really even you know, within the last 10 or 20 years, there have been several MERS, SARS, swine flu. Talk about a little bit from a historical perspective what those numbers look like relative to what we've seen so far with the coronavirus, if you could.
Yeah, sure will, Dave. And first of all, let me just mention one statistic on this virus that I haven't mentioned, and that is that it is estimated that the fatality rate, if based on the cases, is about 2 to 2.3%. If you look at the actual case numbers, it's looking like 3.5%, but the scientists, the medical experts are believing that it's around 2.3, and they also think that that's going to fall as protocols improve, and as it is in other countries, they think that's going to come down. So I'll just keep that in mind. I'm going to make some comparative comments here. A comparison that is worth looking at with this is the swine flu, which occurred back in 2009-2010. And this really floored me when I read this because it shows you how our memories fade. There were actually almost 61 million documented cases in the U.S., 274,000 hospitalizations, and over 12,000 deaths in the U.S. from swine flu. Obviously, pretty dramatic event. Globally, they estimate that it affected somewhere between 700 million and 1.4 billion people and might have killed somewhere between 150,000 to 575,000 people. Much, much larger numbers than what we're seeing with this, and yet the point to be made here is we don't really remember a lot about swine flu because it was about a decade ago. So we hope that's the case with this one as well. Other comparisons are being made are to the SARS virus in 2002-2003. That only had 27 cases in the U.S. and 8,000 globally. But importantly, the SARS death rate was about 9%, you know, several times the amount was estimated with the coronavirus. And then there's MERS, which occurred over a number of years, and the statistics were kept through 2012, where there were just 858 deaths, but the death rate in that virus was severe, 35%, pretty scary virus, and something we've heard about but probably don't really keep top of mind. So those are some of the comparisons with the severe coronaviruses or zoonoses, as they're sometimes called, because they came from animals.
Got it. And lastly, Richard, on TV, the radio, and social media, a lot of conversations comparing this to the flu. You know, generally, I guess, is it a fair comparison? And talk a little bit about the stats between the two. The flu and the coronavirus, how they're similar, how they're different.
Sure will, Dave. And some are starting to refer to this as a nasty flu, and that's because based on the statistics that are there in front of us, it seems to have a fatality rate of about 20 times that of the flu, which is a pretty big increase. But again, it's around 2 to 2.3% estimated, and that may drop. So definitely more deadly than the flu. It's similar to the flu in some other ways as well. Its incubation time is similar to about 2 weeks, which is how you get these asymptomatic people walking around not knowing they're infecting others. It's different from the flu in a couple of ways in that they think that this is not absolutely proven yet, but they think this one can be spread via airborne particles that float around in the air and allow someone to catch it even after the person infecting you is gone. So that is a little bit more infectious than the flu, if that's the case. They believe it may be. They also hope and don't know yet whether this has seasonal variability like the flu. It's not known yet because we haven't gone through a season, but the hope is that when the weather warms, this virus won't be able to survive outside of a person as long, and therefore it will be much less infectious at that point. And finally, this virus is one particular strain, very individualized, whereas the flu has multiple types and strains, which is why the flu vaccine tends to not always hit the mark because it continually replicates and changes.
All right.
Yep. Wrapping up, Dave, one more thing. The flu has a much higher prevalence in the population, and we don't get afraid of it that much. We think it infects somewhere between 9 and 45 million people in the U.S. every year.
Got it. Thank you, Richard. Paul Teton, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So you heard Richard with a pretty thorough coverage of the facts around the impacts, and I guess from an economic standpoint, the result of worries about the spread is quarantines and people halting travel and canceling plans, and obviously that's going to have an economic impact. And let's start in China because, a lot of the economic data coming out of China reflects the virus because they had it sooner. They've been dealing with it a lot longer than we have in the U.S. So talk about China and what we're looking at from an economic impact there.
Sure. Well, we've been waiting for hard evidence from China of economic disruption, and there has been precious little until last weekend when we got our first real look at serious disruption in the Chinese economy. They reported, as they do every month, a series of economic indicators called Purchasing Managers Indexes, which are basically surveys in the manufacturing sector and in the non-manufacturing sector of purchasing managers who respond whether things are better or worse this month. And so it's a percent of respondents reporting better is what's reported. And basically, the numbers that came out for February were really ugly and frankly stunning and startling. The magnitude of collapse is really the word it appears to have occurred in the Chinese economy in February. So these are just surveys, but they tend to correlate pretty well, at least in the manufacturing part, with industrial production and output and with consumption on the services side. So it's pretty clear that something really bad has occurred in the Chinese economy. There were reports from spokesmen of the Chinese Statistics Bureau that were dismissive of this, saying really it's just kind of extended vacation for the Chinese New Year, and things will be back to normal here by the end of the month, which my read is that is disingenuous in the extreme. There is no prior occurrence around a Lunar New Year, which, by the way, was in late January. The Chinese market closed in the last week in January, reopened February 3rd. But there is no prior history of this magnitude of decline associated with a lunar holiday. And in fact, the only comparable decline in the manufacturing purchasing managers index was in the fall of 2008. And it took 6 months for that decline to develop. And in February, it was worse than what we saw in 2008 and occurring in 1 month. So long story short, serious disruption appears to be in play in the Chinese economy, which, as we all know, is sort of the nexus of the global supply chain. So disruption is expected to ripple out towards much of the many of the economies of the developed world and developing that are engaged in global trade.
Well, from a longer term perspective, in our year-end call, we talked about how the trade tensions between the United States and China led to a lot of companies reevaluating manufacturing and supply chains, and we saw this shift to other countries. I have to think that this is only going to continue to lead companies to sort of reevaluate their situation. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a very fair statement. I think there's not a lot of evidence that the supply chain has moved significantly yet. The trade war is really only, the tariff war is really only a year or year and a half in, and it just takes a while for some of these, you know, very technologically advanced production systems to move, and the question is move to where? Saigon does not have the infrastructure to support, you know, a big semiconductor industry. So it's a problem to move quickly, but your point is well taken. This is certainly another very flashing red light that, you know, people who are dependent on China for their supply chain are going to reassess and take a harder look at you know, diversifying their production sources.
Great. Let's shift over and talk maybe briefly about the EU, but really kind of focus in on the U.S. EU is already struggling. This obviously, you know, a lot of their GDP is dependent on tourism, you know, and obviously that's going to be problematic. But the U.S., you know, in terms of economic data that we received to this point, we had a decent PMI number yesterday, but it's still coming, right? I mean, we're going to feel the impact. It's not just showing in the data yet. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's the correct statement. Europe, just quickly, and Germany specifically, is more exposed than any other economy in Europe to global trade. Germany is a capital goods you know, dominator. They produce very fine capital equipment, machinery that makes other machines and such, airplanes, and they have run a big trade surplus with China with those goods. And so they had a mild recession last spring, a negative GDP quarter, but bounced back to, you know, small marginal positive GDP growth in the fall, and so avoided the technical and conventional definition of a recession, which is two consecutive quarters of negative growth. But it seems clear they are headed back into the soup and very likely to have a negative quarter here this quarter or sometime here in the first half. So, you know, we'll have to see how this all plays out. The presumption is that this disruption is relatively temporary, that things will get back on track in the fall. And so, you know, we wouldn't call for, you know, a severe collapse of the European economy or the German, for that matter, but certainly a quarter of pretty severe disruption. And same, but less so, less serious in the U.S., we're expecting, we were, before the coronavirus even surfaced, we were expecting basically sluggish growth in the first quarter, continuation of the deceleration in consumption that was occurring in the second half in the U.S. And so it seems clear that, you know, without being able to put a number on it, that some sort of low side variance on those forecasts in the first half is the likely outcome. I've seen reports saying that the first quarter might be less than 1%, somewhere between 0 and 1% on seasonally adjusted annual rate growth in the quarter. I think that's probably reasonable, and would have to say that, you know, the odds of a negative quarter in the U.S. Have risen pretty substantially. So that's not to say that recession odds are that high. I don't think they are. But the odds of a negative quarter have risen a lot, and I would call it a toss-up. And so I think our base case is really about the same for the full year that it has been, 1.5% to 2% growth when it's all said and done at the end of the year. But more volatility between the first half and the second half is our assessment. Possibly a negative quarter somewhere in there or something pretty weak, but also very plausibly a pretty strong rebound with some pent-up demand in the fall.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Looking forward to the fall. Martin, what a crazy year for stocks. Obviously, the stock market is trying to digest all of this information and see what sort of impact it's going to have on earnings. You know, we had one of the worst weeks in the almost 100-year history of the S&P 500 last year after a pretty decent start. I think that was sort of lost. So we had a decent start to 2020 with a lot of those gains getting wiped out. Huge rebound yesterday, 4 to 5%, depending on what index you're looking at. And then, you know, just looking at the market this morning, it's been all over the place. With the Fed news, there was a big bounce and then sold off, and it's trying to find its ground, its footing. Give me your thoughts on, you know, I guess, first of all, is this all related to the coronavirus, or is there more at play here, or is it all interrelated?
So can I choose C from that list of
options? Yes, go ahead, please.
It is definitely all interrelated. Coronavirus is certainly the key driver to markets selling off, and in just the, you know, the very recent past, you pointed out how bad last week was. From the intraday high on the Thursday prior to last week, or the Wednesday prior to last week, down to the intraday low Friday morning, the S&P 500 was down almost 16%, and that kind of abrupt change in such a short period of time, that magnitude of change in such a short period of time it's not unprecedented, but it's extremely rare in market history, and you certainly can attribute that to the coronavirus causing a lot of scares. But as you know, you heard from Paul and Richard, and you pointed out, there's a lot of things, a lot of cross currents contributing to the maelstrom here. And I think markets are right now a very high degree of uncertainty about how the virus is going to impact output around the globe and impact growth around the globe in the near future. And so that's where we are right now. You pointed out today, market was down a couple of hundred points at the open, rallied to up 300 points after the Fed announcement, was down again, and now it's up again.
A lot of commentators out there have, you know, talked about how the sell-off was overdone. Any opinions on that? Do you agree? Was it overdone, or is it too early to say?
Well, saying that it was overdone, which I would agree with, that it was overdone, but saying that it was overdone doesn't mean it can't get more overdone. If a market can get overdone in the first place, it can get even more overdone. So it doesn't mean it's over. But yes, I think that, as I pointed out, that's near 16% decline from peak to trough in 7 days was a lot and too much. And I think we can take a good, you know, signal from the markets yesterday and today,
right,
and really from the bottom Friday morning, that, you know, I think from the bottom Friday morning, the S&P 500 is probably up over 5% now. So,
and what about valuation? You know, with this pretty significant steep decline in prices, are valuations more attractive? Or are they just moving in tandem with likely what earnings are going to do?
Well, valuations are certainly lower now than they were, but to call them more attractive is an unanswered question, I think, at this point. You know, if you're looking at trailing earnings, the P/E ratio on the S&P 500 is certainly lower now than it was just 3 weeks ago. But again, there's a lot of concern about what's going to go into that E and how all of this is going to affect growth in the near future. So valuations have come down a bit, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they've become more attractive.
All right. Willing to make a prediction on where we go from here?
Well, the easy prediction is to say that we're in for a period of continued high volatility. I think that is That's the easy answer to that question. And again, trying to figure out if there's a short-term negative impact from the virus, if there's a bounce back from that short-term negative impact, or if it has further ramifications down the road. If various developed economies are edged into recession, or if there's some impact in the polls in the U.S. in the fall, there's a lot of things that remain to be seen that it's going to be hard to make a prediction of where prices go, except that they're going to continue to bounce around violently.
Yep, fair enough. Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Bonds are often unloved until you go through a time like this. And, for clients that have bonds as part of their portfolio, they really are doing their job. That we've seen price improvement on the bond side. They're really acting as that buffer to volatility and preserving capital as intended. So, that's the good news of this story for, a lot of our clients. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the bond market and maybe start on the long end of the curve. We saw the 10-year, almost get down to 1%, which is just crazy when you think about it. The 30-year all-time lows, I think we're at, call it 167 right now, 108 on the 10-year. I mean, these are all-time lows, correct? What's going on?
Well, it's uncertainty around the world. When investors get worried, they buy treasuries. There's no better safe haven in the world than U.S. treasuries. They're liquid. They're safe. They provide deflation hedges. They serve a lot of good during times like this. So, and plus the fact that our treasury securities are some of the highest yielding investments around the world. We've talked in meetings past about negative yields, and they still exist in abundance around the world. So as low as our yields are, relatively speaking, they're still very attractive. So when the coronavirus uncertainty hit the markets, the equity markets especially, people flocked to our treasury markets, and they flocked to the longer end. As you mentioned, 30-year hit all-time low yields. Started the year at about 240. As you mentioned, they're now down to about 1.67%. And the 30-year has been around, I think, since the 70s. And the 10-year has been around a lot longer than that. And it dropped so far this year from about 1.9% down to the 1.1 or 1.10, as you mentioned a second ago. So, this is a time when treasuries do exactly what they're supposed to do, which is provide that a place to some quality that investors can flee to in times of uncertainty.
All right, so let's work our way up the curve, and pretty similar story there for short maturities. If you take a look at the 2-year, for example, and the 3-year for that matter, both around 80 basis points or 0.8%. What's going on there?
Well, somewhat like what was going on the long end, the markets have been anticipating the Fed making a move, which you alluded to earlier. So the shorter end of the curve there really has moved under 1% in the last week or so in this flight to quality. With the Fed announcement this morning, it moved even more so into the lower yield realm. Now from 9 months all the way out to 5 years, you can't find a treasury with a 1%, we call it handle, over 1%. They're all under 1% at this point. What is a little ironic right now is that a 3-month T-bill yields more than a 10-year treasury. 3-month T-bill somewhere around 1.13%, if I'm reading, on the screen here, and the 10-year, of course, at 1.10. So the curve, that's the definition of an inversion, curve inversion. But what it's really telling you is that that the market thinks that there's probably more activity out there on the Fed's part. So they haven't moved below, but there's a dramatic move lower this morning on the short end of about 25 basis points in reaction to the Fed.
Yeah. So let's just go ahead and talk about the Fed. You probably had to throw all your notes away from, you know, 35 minutes ago. So 50 basis points, is there another cut in the future, do you believe?
Well, certainly it's highly likely. It's not certain. I know the Fed would like not to have to cut, but we just don't know what the extent of the damage to the global economy the coronavirus is going to have. So at this point, nobody really knows for certain, but I can tell you that the financial markets, the Fed Fund futures markets, are anticipating at least one and almost two more cuts sometime before January of next year. So you know, that's at this point, I'd say that's likely, and I'd say one cut is highly likely at this point. And it's all part of a global coordinated action. Jay Powell, Fed Chairman, really telegraphed to the world last Friday with a very uncommon action. He printed a statement and posted it on the Fed website 90 minutes before the equity markets closed here in the United States, saying basically that the Fed was watching the situation and ready to take action whenever necessary. That's highly unlikely that they would come out and post something like that. It was basically the dog whistle to central bankers and governments around the world that, okay, it's time to act, which is exactly what they were waiting on. So he acted on that this morning. What the Fed likes to do is make a big splash. They hate taking action that everybody already knows is a fait accompli. So that's why they moved this morning, because they wanted a big headline. They wanted to make a big splash, and I think they were successful in that. But then the question still remains is, you know, what else is out there, and will that be enough? It's, you know, it's something nobody knows at this point. We're just going to have to watch it. The Fed's also got some other things on their plate. Certainly the repo markets, which we've talked about, has got some issues out there that they've got to watch pretty closely, those short-term funding markets. And then the Fed has kind of also opened the door to some of their more aggressive measures, being some form of quantitative easing, as well as other measures that they have in their arrows in their quiver that they could use that aren't typically what are only used in more extreme circumstances.
Jeff, you know, one thing that we've discussed quite a bit as an asset management team, when discussion around the Fed cutting rates first came up, you know, say really a month ago or so, was will it really be effective? You know, are people that are not having conferences or not traveling or not doing some type of activity that helps economic growth, the Fed cutting rates, does that really change it? What do you think?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't have a direct impact on it. What we know from history is that the Fed is very good at influencing the financial markets, the stock market and the bond market. And the Fed rationale has always been that eventually filters into consumer sentiment and then into the entire economy. So there's a lot of debate out there, even among our own team, as to, you know, the efficacy of these types of moves. And I suspect even at the Fed, they have some debate as well. So it's it is something that it does some good, but it's far from a panacea at this point. Yeah. But again, there's some other possibilities out there in terms of Fed acting that could maybe have even more impact.
Paul, I know you have lots of thoughts on this topic. Do you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, thank you, Dave. I think Jeff has summed it up pretty well. I'd say from my perspective, trying to gauge the intersection of Fed policy and economic growth The U.S. economy is really kind of cruising along at pretty much average growth that it's experienced in the last 10 years is not under a great deal of stress. Interest rates are not high and are not the problem. So cutting them isn't really indicated by economic growth. However, global economy is having a spasm of risk aversion and fear, and it does help build confidence. The theoretical rationale for cutting rates here would be that global equilibrium rates are falling, and that central banks should keep their interest rates in sync with equilibrium rates unless they want to tighten up, which they don't. So they're all cutting, and that makes some sense. That's pretty esoteric, and only the economists inside the Fed really talk about that. But I think that the question is, and we think that the rebound in the fall is pretty high probability, and this is probably going to be enough, is the kind of the bottom line. But it does raise the question of, you know, what else do they have? And they don't have much. There's a lot of discussion out there about negative interest rates. Germany has a negative Fed funds rate, and their 10-year government bond yield is minus 63 basis points this morning. So there's a lot of discussion about what if that were to happen in the U.S., and the short version is we just don't think the Fed is really has any interest in going there. We're the world's reserve currency. The disruption would be pretty extreme and really open up a whole Pandora's box of uncertainties. How does this work for the reserve currency to have negative interest rates, to completely sever the relationship between savings and capital investment, encourage companies to borrow exorbitantly for any needs. So it's just everything points in the wrong direction to go there. I don't think they want to do that. That does leave quantitative easing as, you know, the tool that they would likely go to if they feel the need to spur activity or try to elevate the consumer moods further. So there are long-term problems with that that we don't need to get into here, but we'd rather see the U.S. economy prosper without the Fed printing money would be the short version of that. And again, to bring that kind of back, we're hopeful and expect that in the fall it's a stronger economy and we're not talking about negative interest rates or quantitative easing, but those are the tools that remain out there.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Jeff. Obviously, we had a lot to talk about today. We went way over time. Apologies for that. We were going to talk about Super Tuesday. Obviously, with Steyer, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar dropping out, the field is narrowed considerably, which is going to make for some interesting discussion next time we meet, which will be on April 7th at the same time, 9 a.m. For those of you that are first-time listeners or maybe aren't getting all of our insights, we do send out a weekly commentary piece. So if you'd like to receive more frequent updates from the asset management team, please reach out to any Hancock Whitney associate or email me directly at david.lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at hancockwhitney.com, and we'd be happy to get you on that distribution list. So thanks again for joining, and we'll talk with you next month.